And Henry always referred to him as old George Kimball, because old George Kimball insisted on trying to write things down, you see, and get them straight, whereas Henry was tearing off far beyond this. So, and you press me further, whatever details you want, but that's what happened with the books. They just didn't pay much attention.
Pauling and Wilson's book had come out.
Oh, yes, yes. Pauling and Wilson was out, and of course you had to read that the first 2 weeks. And,
if you've ever seen that book, Marcy, you know why I'm laughing.
Yes. And this Wilson was the smart student who then went on to Harvard and who's won all of these other things. His and he, Marcy, because you're getting a feeling of what the genealogy of this is. Jeffrey has a good feeling. His son is a Nobel Prize winner at Cornell, who was here not too long ago, Kenneth Wilson, and is working on.
You mentioned Smith was one of your fellow students in that seminar. Do you recall who else was?
Oh, yes. The whole gang were there, and Stevenson from Berkeley was particularly effective. Kassman didn't come in until a year or two later. Beach was a postdoc who sat in. He was from Berkeley. Eccles, CHOLS, I think he was Carnegie Institute. He wasn't primary luminaries, but he was a good fellow. Eddie, who became professor at Tufts and died only just a year or so ago, Bob Eddie, we'll get to Eddie in a moment because he's one of the few in our group that went into inorganic chemistry. I'll follow this down a little further. Do you want more?
Oh, no, we might as well go on. I do want to come back, though, to the departmental seminar.
Yes, you bet. Okay, the inorganic thing is worth pointing out, because this was a transition period, too, in that, of course, before the time we're talking about, inorganic chemistry was the delight of the age. There was a man named Smith at the University of Edinburgh, and there were a couple at Oxford and Cambridge who pursued the thing pretty much on the German pattern, you see. They brought the thing along from the century before. Now, Menges, who was a Scotsman, was a strong disciple of the British school. He had taught at Chicago for a while, and he was a most intriguing. His daughter is the principal Princeton photographer for a great many years. I haven't seen her for several years, but she's probably responsible for most of the graphics of Princeton of the past 50 years or so. Anyway, Menges was another character, because he felt that hiring was probably a flash in the pan and would disappear after a while. But Menges, on the other hand, had very amusing, he was pretty much up to date. He felt that Werner complexes had told you a great deal about inorganic chemistry. This is way ahead of his time, you see, because Cotton and the other people now are pointing this out. Menges didn't quite know what they told you, but he had a great instinct that did. Well, I think he had a deep feeling that here was some kind of balance between ionic bonding and the covalency, you see, and he had us making these things. I made all these complexes Saturday after Saturday, an admirable laboratory exercise, but he also had a very amusing feeling for some of the earlier inorganic chemists, the fellow at Wisconsin who didn't believe in ions, and they called him the great ionoclast, because these ions, you know, are really basic elements of chemistry. Yeah. And so Menges was invigorating that way. Richards, I had very little to do with. Richards drank himself to death. He was a son of Theodore William Richards at Harvard, who was for some time the greatest American chemist. He was sort of progenitor of G.N. Lewis. You probably have things about Theodore William Richards. But this Richards was a highly appealing person, very cultivated, very brilliant. Goodness knows what he would have done if he hadn't had so many other diversions. He died fairly early, but I really had very little. Color chemistry didn't profound impression. Didn't make much impression on Richards either, and we were beginning to get away from it. It was it's a chemistry, as you probably know, Marcy, of aggregates long before we really got into solid state. If they'd been smart, they would have got into solid state that way. Smith was a great exponent of the German school of metallurgists, Das System. And Smith was the last. Smith still had influence when Mari Tannenbaum studied metallurgy, for instance, he comes in. He has some influence on Mare, and you probably know Mare.
I know.
Doing very well in ATT. Then here's Smythe on like your structure, and Smythe was just a very thoughtful, scholarly exponent of what was being learned. Of course, he had studied with Debye not only on dipoles, which we'll undoubtedly come back to, but in electron scattering. And Beach, who was one of the fellows I mentioned from Berkeley, came with him during the years I was there and made the world's most sophisticated electron diffraction laboratory. Built it from the ground up. Beach really did the design. Smythe helped somewhat. And we built it there. I had a very minor part in it. This was crucial because there was a great argument between Pauling and Debye, you see. Debye pointed out that a lot of Pauling's diffraction analyses were illusions because there weren't actual maxima in the diffraction. There were simply large-scale variations in intensity. Well, Debye was right, but Pauling was right, too, in that you could derive from those shells values of the diffraction parameters that did give you the distance between atoms and molecules. This is the first time anybody had a really accurate spacing inside a molecule. We had the work in crystals before. So this was an exciting deal, and Smythe was much involved in that. But, of course, the dipoles and the dielectric properties of solids were his special interest. And, of course, he was encouraged, I think, by Iron's theoretical work, but he was already committed to the notion that you could do something about the chemistry of solids, which people generally were not much concerned with. Solid state was a pure fantasy at that stage. Now, down in physics department, Digner was creating physics of solids, much the most enterprising in the world, but he came to Europe, of course, and he brought it into Princeton with the great tradition of von Laue and Sommerfeld and others. He had a fascinating interaction with Iring because Digner, very rigorous, very elegant, and Iring thought that was a waste of time, that you, with chemistry giving way to quantum mechanics as it was, you didn't bother with rigor and elegance. But they got along personally pretty well, and they sort of argued each other out of things. Digner thought Iring was crazy, and Iring thought Digner was rigid and impossible, but they got along quite well. Digner, of course, still very active there. Now, what I was getting to in this is that Seitz and Conyers-Herring were primary students of Digner's, and they really brought this along. I got to know Conyers in particular very well, and that got convinced that chemistry and physical chemistry of solids had a future as well, because Conyers, with Wigner at that point, was demonstrating that lithium and to some extent sodium chloride, but the metal lithium figure, could be understood from first principles of quantum mechanics, you see. So everything was coming together there. So much for Smythe. We'll get back to him. Now, Furman was the very distinguished analytic fellow, as you know, at that stage, and you folks are doing some very interesting work on this. American analytical chemistry has had its ups and downs, and it was following T.W. Richards and others, it was in a down stage, but not with Furman. Furman had grabbed the analytical techniques, which had a profound effect on me, because when we came to, well, I'll mention a couple of cases, but when we came to the synthetic rubber deal and so on, we had injected that whole phase of chemistry in there, and Williams here, Martin knows very well, who became the national head of the program, went out and captured these, Koltoff and Berman and various others, to do it. Well, this had a very strong effect on me at this stage, because they were using the voltammetry, the new electrochemistry, the very, very early hints, as a matter of fact, of chromatography, but particularly the old field of electrometry with great elegance. The chap who was his name for a moment, who was assistant to Furman and who became professor at Ohio State for a great many years, just died last year, was also quite a good teacher.
Earl Cayley?
Yes, Cayley. Earl Cayley, you're right. I do Cayley very well, so I'll say, well, I might as well say now that Cayley had so good of influence, and Furman did, that when I was sort of finishing, well, as a matter of fact, this was kind of a, an extension of the undergraduate work. I enjoyed very much their courses in advanced analytical chemistry, you see, that I undertook a little job for Cayley that was based on triple acetates, uranyl triple acetates. Now, this was 1937, 38, I guess the publication was probably in 39, is that right? And the nuclear fission was had been discovered, you see, and they desperately needed methods of analyzing uranium. We didn't, when we first began this, it was kind of a curious study because it had very high molecular weight. As an analytical reagent, people said you couldn't handle that kind of thing, triple acetate. But then it began to appear that people were getting very interested in uranium, and this had the largest leverage factor in uranium analysis. That's a factor so that if what you separate gives you a magnified measure of the atoms you're looking for, the ions you're looking for. So we did this initial work on the characterization analysis of uranium through that urinal acetate salt, triple acetate salt. And I was always very intrigued. This was kind of a hobby almost. But Cayley, it reflects your point you're making here, that Cayley and Furman really had a first-rate analytical milieu there. You see, and the fact that we did this early work in uranium was somewhat coincidental with its later importance, but it worked out very well. We had very accurate results. Then we come to the other domain, which was the organic work. Well, the organic work never got to the levels of Harvard, Illinois, California, etc. There was always a strong struggle. They were competent, but they never had a large enough operation to get those levels. Matyu was Hungarian, extraordinary humor and ability and humanism. He was deserving. He never got to the same, quite the same group as Wigner, Teller, that particular colony of Hungarian physicists. But in chemistry, he had many of the same properties. He was creative, had all the old cultural background of Hungary, and he studied carbohydrates in a way which I found very intriguing. I took a lot of his courses, and I particularly worked with him in organic analytical work, because I thought that somebody ought to be able to apply modern physical chemistry to the characterization of complex molecules. You see, this is a little predecessor to the polymer era. And his Claude Hudson, and Hudson's in your list, who went to Princeton for a while, then he went down to Washington and headed much of the sugar and carbohydrate work. Matyu had a little finger in solid-state chemistry, too, Marcy, in that you can't crystallize these darn things very well, and there was a great legend, which I'm sure everyone's encountered, that certain laboratories had nuclei in the dust, in the air, you see, and that if you did experiments on new sugars, new carbohydrates in those laboratories, you'd be able to crystallize it, and then you'd have something. And if you didn't do it, why, you know what you had. Well, Watcher's laboratory had some of those nuclei, so we were able to crystallize things. Wallace was a lively fellow, premature death, had a good important part in the Merck, early Merck work in antibiotics, like took his courses, but I never got close to him. Daugherty created the worst smells in the Eastern Hemisphere, sulfur chemist, and you have no idea how these could permeate the whole region. Took only a few molecules. Sorry, died over here. Probably inhaled enough sulfur.
Were you a formerly in the program between the physics and chem departments away? For instance, Joseph Hirschfelder a few years earlier had been a student of both Ira and Wigner.
Right. Joe was finishing up that, and I began in there over that for a couple of years. And indeed, I was rather inspired by Joe's work. He was an Ira disciple, of course, and. Yes, I did not formally line as quite as much as he did, but it was substantively just about the same. I mentioned these courses of Lembeck and Turner and the fellow who did the first do some work that became there and became president of the University of Pennsylvania and became the agent.
Carnwell?
Yeah. Worked with his apparatus in Pennsylvania. I remember that I produced some of the targets that he had. See, these were neutrons before there were bombs, and nobody knew exactly what they were going to do. And so Chadwick had discovered things. When Chadwick came here, we had a great time with him. I was his host, and we just built the auditorium over there, and it had a screen floor, you know, so there was no reflection. You have to walk out in a chamber that's 40 or 50 feet tall. I couldn't get Chadwick to do it. He was scared of it. You probably don't do it either. Okay. Here Chadwick had discovered the neutrons. But anyway, this was a rambling answer to your question. Yes, we combined physics and chemistry pretty much as I had indicated in the first place.
Did you have any contact with the heavy water work that was going on in the department at that time?
Not really. By contact, we were all well informed because Hugh Taylor had gotten hold of this with Urey, you see. He and Urey had gotten to be very congenial, and Hugh Taylor had struggled with the kinetics of hydrogen reactions so long that he felt that deuterium just had to be the magic tracer. And so he did introduce, and he got Harold Urey, who was at Columbia, enough deuterium, deuterated material, so he got some very early kinetics results using deuterium as a tracer. Then he got very interested in isotope separation, but this was still before the nuclear reactions, because there was a young fellow in Germany, I'd have to dredge up his name if we could, who had worked on thermal diffusion, he was a physicist, separation, thermal diffusion of deuterium or of hydrogen-bearing compounds, where the lower diffusion rates of the deuterium component would permit you to have a separation due to thermal diffusion. I can see the thing just as plainly as if yesterday Hugh Taylor set up a column in the stairway, you see, the stairway of Frick, which had about four stories at that point, and Nelson Trenner and a couple other people had to spend their lives making that darn thing work, because you had a hot interior and a cold exterior, and the separation factors would be parts per million or parts per billion, but there was a slight enrichment. So Taylor pushed that, and this is all by way of saying that your thing perhaps of his work in the nuclear, in the bomb age or something on the...
No, this is just what I was asking about.
In
the mid-30s, he began...
I was well informed, but I mean, we all had to be. But I had nothing to do with it, really.
Well, you started to mention the seminar when Bohr described the new work on fission, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about both that seminar and also other seminars in the chem department and elsewhere at Princeton.
Yes, well, these were very active matters, which occurred at least weekly, but sometimes more than that. And they were sponsored by Taylor, who always sat up front but kept very close check of whether everybody else was sitting in the rear. That is, the students in particular were expected to turn up at these. These were their main attraction during, you can hardly imagine this as in the age of the present, that the main attraction was you had free tea. which was pretty rare, you see. But Taylor saw to it that this seminar room was indeed well equipped with tea and a certain kind of cookie, which was absolutely decisive for the attendance of all the graduate students, which is exactly what he wanted. They were very exciting events. Leonard Jones had a classic debate with Eyring about the structure of the activated complex, you see. The major figures, Pauling, of course, came, people came from Europe, major figures in physical chemistry, with a certain interlarding of physicists, and we'll get to the Bohr item. There were exciting revelations. These were a matter of part of the afternoon, and it was less exciting after the tea, there was a certain amount of drowsing. Well, Taylor never did that himself, but he never looked back. Professors came sporadically. Eyring usually pretty active, and Eyring would get up about halfway through, or sometimes all the way through the visitor's talk and explain to the visitor what he really meant, because the visitor was not as well acquainted with the modern. See, this was when quantum mechanics was really getting injected into chemistry, and these poor visitors, who were very distinguished people, were following along great tradition, describing some kind of experiments or descriptions or hypotheses that they had thought were all right, but I knew he was had a better one. Oh, yes. Oh, my, yes. They would stand there with their mouths literally open, you see, because I was a very dynamic person. He died in 81 or 2 just a couple years ago. I saw Greg Levin in his later years quite regularly, and that was all very amusing because he never lost the buoyancy and enthusiasm. And you probably have a separate chapter on hiring. Then in physics, I used to, for the reason that I was enrolled in the thing, used to go to their seminars pretty often too. Einstein would come fairly often. I could always find out that I didn't understand what was happening some of the time, but if something significant was being said, Einstein was saying, he would sit up front. So that was the old Palmer Laboratory, and that was fairly helpful signal. Those seminars were pretty heavily devoted to nuclear physics, which was going strongly. There was barely a taste of Wigner's work. Wigner was carrying on, but he wasn't spending a lot of time in giving seminars on subject. But there were very interesting talks with the nuclear people and with astrophysics and things of that nature, so that people from Copenhagen were quite regular attendees. So were the people from Berlin, Stuttgart, the southern Germany universities, which were very active, Munich, Heidelberg. And so we kept through that seminar thing, but particularly through the physics seminars, a fairly close touch with what was going on in those institutions. And Bohr was there for a semester. I mention all this because it was kind of an environment that he enjoyed. Wheeler had just joined the faculty as a very young professor and Wheeler, and been very friendly with a couple of us in chemistry. So we'd known him very well. And Bohr got a cable from Hahn, I think it was, a Strassmann scientist, saying that the uranium had undergone fission and gave these large nuclei. Well, Bohr was astonished. I think nobody thought you'd get that kind of splitting. You thought it was alpha particles or other things that was expected. So he called a seminar for about 5 o'clock in the Palmer Laboratory. People realized something was going on, so they had it in a large room, lecture room, and they equipped Bohr, who was a noted mutterer, a noted mumbler, with a microphone. In those days, it had to have a cable to a loudspeaker, you see, and Bohr took off on the explanation of nuclear fission. First, he described what he'd been told. He got his information from Germany. And so quite early in the seminar, it became clear that there was a strong possibility of Bohr choking himself because he held on to this thing and he'd get the cord around his neck. But we managed to get through that. The more memorable even feature of it was that he would, a big blackboard, and he would write this reaction with these fission particles, and then he would try to estimate the energy, the energetics of it, which of course looked as though you were getting an enormous energy emission plus an actual conversion of mass, you see, and the conversion of mass of course was the terribly revolutionary part of it. And so Bohr would think about this, and he'd get along, he'd say what he thought the probable mechanism was, for example the water drop model. Earlier in the afternoon, he and Wheeler had done some work on that. And then he would get a slight revision of ideas so that he'd mumble the end of the sentence and you couldn't hear it. Then he'd start all over again, have another mechanism, and he'd get to the end of that sentence, mumble that, you see. Well, these were, you can see, very strong impressions one got, but they were symptomatic of the excitement and the energy of the period in which everybody was learning a lot. These seminars, as I sort of implied before, were frequently sort of carried on at the graduate college because the people, both professors and the students, the visiting professors, would often live there, you see, and so we'd have evening sessions which were exceedingly illuminating, informal enough so that you could really get exchange. They completely abandoned the old European traditions of ter professor, and you really got ignoramuses like myself with a chance to talk back and forth and ask questions. There was a fellow, a brilliant young business named Feo, who was a very good friend, and he would help us phrase the questions somewhat. And Robbie used to come down there, and he'd come down for these evening events in Columbia and spend all night. And we had very lively discussions.
I was going to say, you mentioned quite a few people, Europeans, coming over to partake in what was going on at Princeton. Did people like Eyring or other people go to other European universities to proselytize their ideas, or was it all coming from
America? No, they exchanged. They went over. Of course, in those times, there was a very free exchange, and Taylor went every other year, Smythe went every other year, not been the whole year, but at least the summer and to some extent a month or two in Germany and Britain. There was relatively less interest in France, no interest in Japan, but very strong exchanges in the UK and Germany. To some extent in Brussels, there was Brussels was a very lively Paris of the North in those days. There was a professor named Herrera, who was a pioneer in infrared spectroscopy, and you see, in that kind of spectroscopy, you have dipole moments that determine the transition probabilities, and he was a good friend of Smythe's. He spent some time in Princeton, Smythe spent some time there. Then Taylor got interested in Louvain. That was where the Abbé Dibney was having ideas about the origin of the universe, but there was also some very interesting work on the kinetics of chemical change there. Make a good point. We had a very clever methods. They partly teaching, partly books, partly methods of conference and so forth. Keep the whole Atlantic basin into exchange.
I think what comes to my mind, and we'll get to it probably in the next week, is how this free flow of ideas, including other universities, other countries, seems to be the echo kind of what took place at their labs later, sharing patents and the free flow of ideas.
Yes, now the Bell Laboratories was not detached from all this, of course. The solid state era hadn't come on, but the discovery that electrons were waves was absolutely basic to all the chemistry and physics we've been talking about. And then Morgan, S.O. Morgan from here, had been one of Smythe's earliest students, joined the laboratories and had begun work in dielectrics here. So that had attracted a lot of interest in the university world.